I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Damon Fairless has written one of the more anticipated books of the year. Mad Blood Stirring the Inner Lives of Violent Men looks at the violence inside men. There are men that he talks to that have committed terrifying violence, rape, murder, as well as the violent tendencies the author has himself experienced. The book opens with Mr. Fairless narrating an incident on a subway where he was standing up to a bully who was threatening his wife and other passengers. He headbutts the fellow, and so begins this book that looks at his upbringing and the feelings that he contends with. This book is particularly timely in the era of the Me Too movement. Damon Fairless is a writer and journalist. He has a degree in neuroscience and has worked as a producer for the CBC radio program As It Happens. The book is published by Random House. Please welcome to the Planta Online program Damon Fairless. Mr. Fairless, good morning.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. One of the more compelling things about your book is that you discuss your own life. And I guess, is your own experience, is that what really set you off on this journey?
Yeah, I think it is, though it kind of was a roundabout way of getting there. So, you know, I had been in, I've been in a ton of fights, but, you know, I had been in enough fights, enough kind of serious fights. I write, at the beginning of the book, I write about headbutting a guy in a subway.
Yeah.
You know, he was being aggressive and you know, I think people were afraid of him and stuff, and I just kind of had it with him. And I've done things like that a few times, you know, late into my 30s. You know, I was kind of still behaving like I was a 19-year-old in some ways. So I think that started me thinking about my own behavior. But, you know, I wasn't, to be honest, I started writing the book, primarily writing about other guys, the guys that I, you know, profiled in the book, without doing a huge amount of self-examination, because at that point I was kind of, you know, I was telling those stories, my fight stories, like they were kind of, you know, cool acts of bravado.
Right.
I wasn't really, I hadn't really kind of peeled back the layers enough to kind of really do the serious examination that, you know, is in the book now. So I was kind of interested in those stories, just the stories, and then the stories of the more seriously, you know, egregiously violent guys, you know, done time and, you know, killed people, raped people, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But then, you know, after I did that, I kind of came back to myself and started thinking, well, why do you do the things you do? So, yeah, it was a pretty big bit of self-examination there.
Yeah, you describe, until I read your book, I wasn't familiar with you. I mean, I've seen your name around, and you worked on radio for a bit, I've never seen you physically. You describe yourself in the book, you're what, 6'3", is that right?
Yeah, that's right, 6'3".
Yeah, you're a big guy, right?
Yeah, I'm a big guy, yeah.
Yeah, and so one wonders, when you're that size, and I'm assuming you were that size from, say, oh, I don't know, high school on?
Yeah, late high school. Yeah.
Yeah. Picking fights or getting into fights is something that I don't know why I just think that, because I'm under 6 feet. Mm-hmm. That's something that big people get into.
Well, you know, I don't know. I love the question because that still puzzles me. I definitely can say for myself that I don't think I would have gotten in the fights I got in without having, you know, a lot of meat behind it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, when I get in these situations, I get angry, I get full of rage, and I suspect a part of what's going on in my head has been like, you know, can I take this guy?
Mm.
I think I can probably take this guy because I'm big. I'm not a great fighter. Like, I'm not by any means anywhere close to, you know, some of the pro fighters I hung out with. I can handle myself, but
yeah,
there are a lot of people, including a lot of people a lot smaller than me, who can make, you know, make me pretty messy pretty quickly. So I do think that me being big is part of it. But interestingly, I also think that me being big is part of the reason psychologically. What I mean, I kind of talk about it a bit in the book, but when you're a kid and you grow into this big body, you still feel like a kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, but all of a sudden, you're being looked at by other guys in the world as a big dude.
Yeah.
And so you start to get these, like, I think, you know, we hear when women go through puberty, suddenly men start looking at them a lot differently,
uh-huh,
right? And they start seeing them as sexual creatures, and that can be really weird for a girl who's like 12 or 13 that's just gone through this big growth spurt. You know, it's kind of creepy, right? similarly, like when you're like, for me, 17, 18, getting into this big man's body and still feeling like a kid, that it kind of freaks you out, or at least it freaked me out, because guys would start sizing you up.
Yeah.
Right? And I found, like, when I was in early university, going out to a bar or a club or something just was so anxiety-provoking, because I'd always be the guy that inevitably some drunk dude or some couple of drunk dudes wanted to pick a fight with, because they want to test themselves. And they probably also know, you know, as a young guy, and it's not like I was I'm not like sluggish looking, I'm not a mean looking guy. So they probably thought, oh, I can take them as a big guy and get merit points for that. And, you know, so it is a little anxiety provoking being a big guy. And I do think that that's part of it. But also, I think that on the other scale, like I always say, it's always the quiet, small guys you have to watch out for. Because a big guy has a lot of weight behind him, even if he's a lousy fighter. But a small guy has often been the target of a guy's as well, because he's small, and they've had to learn how to handle themselves. Really, like the more technically proficient fighters, and a good buddy of mine who was a former MMA fighter, pro fighter, he's about 160 pounds and is about a full foot shorter than I am.
Uh-huh.
And he can clean my clock. So it's maybe on like both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of a roundabout answer.
No, and so this is very interesting, because you also describe what it was like to grow up in the family that you grew up in, and I mean, you didn't even play board games that were competitive.
Yeah, it was a pretty I mean, my mom in particular was pretty in some ways, you know, a part of the peace movement and part of the, I guess I'll use the term my dad hates it, but, you know, they were considered by a lot of other people fairly granola-ish, fairly hippie-ish.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I was definitely taught to be a sensitive guy who's in touch with his quote-unquote feminine side, for sure, 100%.
And so your brother, who's much younger than you, he had a very different upbringing, is that right?
Yeah, I mean, he's 9 years younger. Our parents divorced. He ended up, you know, he had a more typical upbringing, in the sense that we lived in the suburbs by then, and he watched a lot of TV, played video games, was pretty popular in high school, played rugby, all of the kind of factors that we tend to associate with, you know, bros getting patriarchal and violent and stuff. Like, and I really didn't grow up like that. And yet, here I am, the guy who was headbutting guys on subway, so, you know.
Yeah, so what do you think that says about, because there are a lot of people who will look at the cover of your book and think about the themes that you talk about in the book and wonder if it's something that's inside us as men, or it's something that one grows up with. I mean, it's the nature versus nurture thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think that, to me, the really interesting question is, I think that both of those things are really important to answer. You know, the short version of that answer is both of those things are important. I think that it's really the problem with when you take a nature versus nurture approach is you start to look at a bunch of factors. You look at genetics or testosterone or evolutionary psychology. That doesn't explain everything.
Yeah.
And if you look at social factors like, you know, attitudes, men's attitudes towards women, for instance, or, you know, guys are taught to be tough and, you know, scrap or whatever, or, you know, growing up in really harsh social conditions. Those things are all really important, but it doesn't explain everything. Everyone who's abused as a kid, or everyone who grows up in a, you know, impoverished inner city, does not go on to murder people or beat people up, right? So I guess where I was really interested in is I don't think we can understand, I couldn't understand myself, and I don't think we can really understand men's behavior without kind of breaking apart that it's this or that and start looking at the interaction between the nature and the nurture. I mean, I have 100% environmental factors, attitudes, the things you grow up with, the culture you live in, the socioeconomic conditions, all these things are hugely important. But so are things like testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
So are things, the fact that we, men and women, have slightly but different bodies, with different hormonal systems. And those hormonal systems are very different, particularly in our youth, you know, starting in our mid-teens and going into our late 20s. Guys, testosterone is through the roof. Testosterone won't make you violent. It'll certainly make you super socially competitive. And, you know, violence is one way of sorting out social hierarchies. So I think, you know, I was trying to look at the big picture, and the whole time I was worried that I'm going to be pissing off, you know, some camp, the nature camp or the nurture camp. But, I mean, I kind of think you have to look at the bigger picture, right?
Yeah. And so I guess a way you do that is you look at, say, how we evolve growing up. And you mentioned a moment ago the stuff that you went through. I mean, growing up is tough enough, and you really see that in this book, because you see just how insecure a lot of young people are, men especially, and how that contributes to their behavior.
For sure, yeah.
Do you think addressing sort of the isolation, the insecurity that young people have especially, will do anything to address, say, the problems of the bravado that young people have?
I mean, I'd like to give you a definitive answer and say yes. I'd be lying if I told you I had any clear-cut, you know, solutions. But I do think, I can tell you for myself, writing this book was a whole lot of work. Part of the work was going inside myself and addressing those insecurities. I think that those insecurities, you know, we talk about, you know, the male ego or male insecurities or whatever. I think those things are real. They tend to get a little derided or belittled, but I think that part of being a social creature, and a social creature that evolved to sort out social hierarchies by physical confrontation, it's a very real part of, and it's a very real part of life still these days, but it was a major part of life throughout the development of our species and into, you know, up until like a few years ago, really. I mean, even schoolyard bullying was...
Yeah.
Thing that people had to deal with. We didn't think about it. But the fact is that we have these anxieties about physical confrontation and being able to, you know, sort that stuff out, because it's a reality. And I think that a lot of guys, including myself, have anxieties about being able to, you know, hold your own, being able to present in a way that's tough enough to, you know, be left alone. And I found, like, I had a conversation with a guy who's become a very good friend of mine, who I didn't end up writing about, but he spent 20 years in prison, and he talks about this mask of toughness he put on to survive prison. This guy is just an enormous guy. He's a tough-looking guy. He's also an incredibly sensitive guy, a creative guy, and a very smart guy, but you'd never know that looking at him. So when he started telling me about actively building this armor, you know, doing steroids, getting huge, getting all these tattoos, ever smiling, wearing sunglasses all the time, building this armor around him to toughen up, I started to realize, oh, you know, I do that too. Maybe not to the same extent. And when I started to realize that when I started to acknowledge these insecurities I didn't really want to acknowledge, it really helped me understand, oh, well, this is why, you know, I get so freaked out when I'm confronted with a big aggressive bro and I want to punch him out, because that's actually my fear making me do that.
Yeah,
it presents as aggression. So I do think there's a lot to be gained by talking about these anxieties, because I think, like, now I've talked to some of the toughest, nastiest, horrible guys.
Right.
And they all have these fears.
Yeah.
I can't help but think, you know, we don't like talking. Guys don't like talking about this stuff. I think we feel like the other guy's going to call us out for being sissies or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I guarantee, they may not even recognize it, but guys have these insecurities. And I think we can talk about them. I think we can talk about them in a way that doesn't become like a caricature of the little man syndrome or the man with a fragile ego. Like, these are real insecurities that exist because we have to deal with the anxiety of being in a physical world and being physical beings, and the fact that no matter how nice you are, you know, you can get punched out and made to feel really awful.
Yeah.
I have a dude who's bigger and meaner, right?
You talk to some frightening people in the book, which you've alluded to already. And I'll get you to describe some of them and some of the things that they've been involved with, because I think it's fascinating for people listening to us, especially those listening to us who haven't read the book yet, to see what they're in for. But what strikes me about these conversations that you have with people, with the people that you write about in the book, is that they're so willing to talk to you. And it seems to me that they're looking for someone to listen. And and it's not just because, you know, some of them are have psychopathic tendencies or sociopathic tendencies that they want to talk to you because, you know, that it obviously satisfies them. But it speaks to just how much people want to say something and want to be heard, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's that's kind of the thing, maybe the thing that surprised me the most about the process of writing this book is you can imagine, like, going into, I talked to a guy who's a clinical psychopath, and he was a serial killer and a serial rapist. And then, in addition, I talked to another guy who was just a serial rapist. Going into, like, the super high-max security prison, the special handling unit, going into the forensic hospital where the psychopath resides, I was intimidated, right? But I was also intimidated to talk to, like, you know, guys who were cage fighters or guys who had been in prison or whatever. And what I was intimidated about was, were they going to think I was some sort of flaky snowflake wanting to talk about their precious feelings?
Mm.
And what surprised me is they were like, no, man. They were like, bro, I totally understand what you're talking about. I totally want to talk about that. And I guess, you know, I kind of take that as the book is full of a lot of dark, you know, scary things, obviously. But the kind of silver lining around that is the fact that I got to that dark, scary stuff is because these guys wanted to talk. And they wanted to talk willingly, not because they wanted, you know, a pardon or they wanted to be, you know, they knew what they had done was wrong. They weren't looking to be excused, right? Like the guy who was a serial rapist, he is not ever going to come out of the special handling unit, nor should he, nor does he think he should.
Yeah.
But he did want to, he didn't understand himself. He didn't understand why he did the things he was doing. And I think it was like the first time anyone had talked to him about the feelings he had leading up to his horrendous crimes. I can't help but think that, like, maybe listening to these guys post facto, after they've done these terrible things, you know, we probably could talk about this stuff more and maybe prevent, you know, the emotions from becoming action, right? And I think that these guys, like, they understood too late, maybe. I think they wanted to understand themselves. I think this is not a conversation we're having. It's not a conversation guys feel comfortable having.
Yeah.
So when I went out there, there was a guy, I think a fairly relatable, average guy in some ways, where they felt like, oh, I can be heard, and he's not going to just see me as a monster. Of the things they've done are monstrous, don't get me wrong. But he's going to try to understand, like, how the hell did you get there, man?
Right.
What made you think you could do, like, what gave you, like, what led you down that terrible path, right?
Yeah. So in the course of writing the book, have you got any ideas as to, say, warning signs, if you will, so that these conversations, these serious conversations, meaningful conversations that you're having in the book don't happen in prison, say, and hopefully prevent some of these terrible things that have happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a whole bunch, probably, and again, you know, I'm not an expert in violence prevention. I'm not a clinical psychologist, obviously, but I think that there are a few things. I think, you know, there are one of the commonalities that a lot of these guys had, like the guys who did criminal things, was they were isolated. They didn't have anyone to talk to about these things. I think that they didn't have good role models, maybe particularly male role models.
Mm.
I think that the problem is that they had desires, like the rapists' sexual desires, the psychopaths' murderous desires. They had desires that they were kind of hiding from themselves. That sounds weird, but I think that they were not attuned to what was going on inside themselves. So I think the psychopath is his own. He's someone who is so aberrant that I don't know what, you know, we could have done about him. But I do think probably with the serial rapist, I suspect that if he had had someone to guide him, you know, he grew up without a dad. I suspect if he had someone to guide him to talk to about, like, you know, the sex drive, the male sex drive, as you comes online, so to speak, in your teens, it's overpowering. Now, if you don't have anyone to talk to about that to help guide you through that, if you don't see, you know, how a healthy relationship works, if you've got extremely low self-esteem like he did, poverty, all, he had all of these factors, all these social, economic, cultural factors going against him, and he was isolated, and he was someone who was really ashamed of who he was, and so he wasn't going to talk to anyone about what was going on inside of him. Like, even, you know, like, how was your day at school? He wouldn't have answered those questions. You know, there's this whole constellation of factors, but I think probably, you know, he could have been, you know, mitigated. But, you know, so to answer your question in not a roundabout way, I mean, I think things like isolation, not having role models, older guys modeling healthy behavior, being able to talk about things like, you know, how sex drive will make you do all sorts of silly things, from forgetting to put on a condom because you just want to get into it, so to speak, to neglecting to pay attention to whether your partner's into it. You know, those kind of conversations are really important. And then I think, you know, there are people out there, sadists and stuff, who have really dark thoughts. And I kind of can't help but think maybe we need to be hearing about these more before they become action. So, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not dragging too long, long with this one. But, no. You know, I think one of the most distasteful conversations I had was with a man who had been convicted of sexually abusing his own daughter. And he's obviously a pedophile, but he's a preferential pedophile, meaning he is specifically attracted to underage, you know, the kids. There's a group of pedophiles who run something equivalent to like an AA group, where they get together and they know it's wrong and they don't want to do it, and so they have this kind of support group, and it's pretty effective. The thing is that's a really distasteful group. You know, who wants that group operating in their neighborhood? And so they, and understandably, I get that, but they'll get kicked out of, you know, this hall and that hall and this, or whatever, wherever they're able to hold their meeting. So they're actually being morally responsible by acknowledging the drive in them to do this, you know, horrible, disgusting thing, and then they're making the ethical decision to, you know, own up to it and to support one another in a way that allows them not to do any harm to kids, right? And yet we're shutting them. And I mean, again, I get it. I get the emotional reaction, but they're being shut down over and over again because nobody wants it in their backyard.
Yeah.
So there's this, we're caught between saying, well, these behaviors are disgusting, and absolutely they are, and we shouldn't talk about them because they're disgusting. Well, I think that might be something we want to re-examine, because if we don't understand it, if we don't talk about it, how on earth can you control it? It's like it's like expecting alcoholics to stay away from liquor if they don't have a support group. So I do think that an honest conversation about the darker drives in a lot of us, like mine, like I enjoy punching people.
Yeah.
Like I feel terrible. But then when I hate admitting that, when I see a certain kind of aggressive meathead bro, there's nothing more satisfying than punching that guy in the face and shutting him up. Now, I don't want to do that again because it's unethical and it's destructive and dangerous, and, you know, and I haven't been right. Those guys might just be having a bad day. They might actually be good guys, and I'm bullying them because, you know, I can justify that behavior. But I had to acknowledge that drive in me to be the aggressive alpha in that situation, and then check it, right? But we do have to talk about these
things. Yeah, that's the thing. I'm reading the book, and I'm reading about particular people that you talk to, and uncomfortable, obviously.
Super uncomfortable.
Yeah, and then wondering, what, you know, at some points, I don't really need to read this, but then, you know, when you take the longer view, yeah, I do need to read this, because, especially in this era that we're living in the Me Too movement, I mean, this book comes out at a time where you've had a lot of important conversations with people that we all need to have ourselves.
Yeah, you mean like we need to direct the questions on ourselves, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, this as distasteful and as frightening as some of these things that you write about in the book are for the reader.
Yeah.
We need to hear this, we need to read this, right?
Yeah, when I was writing the book, one of the big balancing acts for me was like, how much of the terrible details do you tell? Because I didn't want to create some sort of real crime, porn. You know,
something gratuitous.
I didn't want to create this gratuitous read. Of course, people will read that. It's fascinating stuff. There's a ton of shows like that that are really fascinating because they're graphic. But my bigger point was like, these are enough of the details to know what people have done. But you want to get to the why, what happened, what was going on inside you, right? That's the takeaway. And I can't help but feel like I wrote this over 5 years, so well before the Me Too movement. But it strikes me as the Me Too movement has come, come into power, so to speak, become kind of one of the main voices in our culture. It's an important, vital movement for, kind of a just society. Like, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think what I've been asking myself is like, what is my role in that movement? I support it. I'm not sure that that's the most effective thing for guys to be. I mean, I'm not saying I shouldn't support it. What I'm saying is that in addition to supporting it, liking posts on Facebook or wearing a pin or whatever, all good. But I think, for the violence against women or sexual harassment against women to go away, I don't see how it happens without guys taking control of their own lanes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see how you can do that, really do it, without going inside and starting to question yourself at a very deep, uncomfortable, worrying level to some extent, and getting mapping the territory in there and being honest with yourself about what's in there, what your motivations are, and then, coming up and saying, well, how do I act in the world? That's an uncomfortable conversation. That's not a particularly popular conversation, but I think it's pretty important. I think before writing this book, I would have said I don't think I would ever be sexually violent. Would I sexually harass a woman? I would have said 100% never. After reading this book, I would say I think it's possible that if I wasn't monitoring myself, I might make a woman feel uncomfortable without necessarily intending to. So I think I'm much in a much better situation to actually monitor my behavior and my intentions than I was beforehand. Just like I'm in a much better position to never get in a fight again.
How much do you think of that is because you're a dad now, and you're a father to a daughter especially?
I think that I owe the lion's share of that transformation to having a child. When you have a kid, the world looks a lot more dangerous all of a sudden. And for me, that, in the middle of writing this, it also meant, hey, you're contributing to that dangerous stuff by being the aggressive, escalatory, guy, starting fights. If I get in a road rage incident, my daughter's in the car, that's on me.
Mm.
Right? No matter how much of a jerk the guy in the other car is, that's on me.
And
so I do think, it's made a real difference. But I think you can kind of like, you can be the childless guy and start thinking, well, how does this affect my partner? How does this affect my mom or my dad or my brother or whatever? We kind of like, young people in particular, but young dudes especially, I think, you're pretty self-centered. You're kind of the center of your world. And it's hard to kind of think about the consequences of your actions. So I think having a kid really does that for people, for sure. It really did it for me, 100%.
How much of the book, it's obviously changed your life in terms of having written it and gone through the journey of writing the book. But what have family relations thought of the book, especially because when you talk about yourself, other people inevitably get drawn into the story.
Yeah.
How have they reacted to say how they might have been depicted or situations that they've been in have been written about?
Well, my wife who I write about that has been super supportive, and we kind of went through, word by word, certain sections to make sure she was cool with it.
Uh-huh.
The other big question there is my mother, who I write about, who is, a troubling person, maybe the more fair way of putting it is we've had a troubling relationship. And I don't know. I don't know how she's reacting to it. I'm not in touch with her. I've passed that section through family members who know her, including her sister, my aunt, and they think it's a fair and accurate representation. But I don't know. I don't know how that's going to play with her. I certainly hope it doesn't. The truth is hard to hear sometimes, and I wouldn't have written what I wrote about her without having good reason, which is, trying to understand myself. But basically everyone I wrote about, with the exception of her, has read themselves and are fine with it.
Yeah. It's a hell of a book, and what's next for you, Damon? Isn't that a dreadful question, especially since you're out flogging this book?
I know, I've got a couple book ideas, but I need to charge my batteries before I go on them, before I get going on anything else. I'm going to relax a bit with my family and do some freelance work and maybe do a little more radio work. But, I'll write something else again.
So you mentioned that it wasn't enjoyable throughout. but now that you're through it and you can look back at it all, I mean, it was worth it, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was totally worth it. There's that thing when you're in writing, the notion that you can't develop a character that you're writing about without putting them through some sort of crisis. And I couldn't help but feel like I wrote about myself, I was the character, and the writing about myself was the crisis. Like, I put myself through hell writing the book. It was hard. Intellectually, it was a hard book to write, but also just, trying to lay yourself out in an objective way and really paint a portrait of your not-so-pleasant inner workings is hard. It's really hard work, but it was totally worth it. I'd do it again. I think it's made me a better person. It's made me a better person.
Yeah.
And that's really, like, if the book doesn't sell or if, it gets bad reviews critically, I don't especially care because it really did make me a better person. I'm super happy I did it.
Yeah, it's a good book and it's a useful one, and I know a lot of people who will pick it up will find something in it that they needed, that alone, was well worth it for the reader. I appreciate your time today. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Yeah, it's been fun. Thank you very much, and all the best.
The book is called Mad Blood Stirring, The Inner Lives of Violent Men. It's from Random House. It's author Damon Fairless. Join me on the line from Toronto and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.